Chapter 34. Going for Baroque. This isn't like the other times I went through the portal, which were a matter of stepping from one place into another with little more than a slight chill. This time, the magic is chaotic and unstable. I'm buffeted around as I fall. My heart lifts into my throat, and my organs jumble around as if they're being stirred into soup. If I'm screaming, I can't hear it over the rushing wind around me. All I can think is that if Mia screwed up the spell, I'll be forever falling through space-time, like a mouse trapped in the walls between rooms, never to land. Then, suddenly, I collide with something solid, the wind punched from my lungs. My vision goes starry. I hear thumps on either side of me. Darby and Mia must have made the jump, too. The blurry colors around us condense into solid shapes. Walls, windows, doors, furniture. I blink away the lights in my vision and make out the other girls lying on the floor, groaning. I'm slumped against a wall, my hair a frizzy mess and my clothes rumpled. But a quick check reveals that all my body parts have come with me, thank Bach. The portal is gone, collapsed almost as quickly as it opened. Darby pushes her hair back and stares wide-eyed at the ground, like she can't believe we made it. Mia grins smugly. "Piece of cake," she says. "Now, just need to figure out where we are," I finish. We're in a huge lobby of some kind, with windows boarded over and large double doors barred from the inside. Stained, moldy carpet covers the floor, and faded, peeling wallpaper hangs in tattered sheets, revealing glimpses of chipped brick walls. Old velvet chairs are scattered around, tipped over, most of them broken, and the Turkish rug under our feet is almost gray with age. I stand up, brushing dust from my black pants. "It's a box office," murmurs Darby, pointing to a booth with glass windows, the panes either shattered or glazed with a thick layer of dust and grime. On either side of it are two arched doorways covered in moth-eaten red curtains. "This place was pretty glamorous once," says Mia. She lifts the corner of a poster that's peeling off the wall. It's hard to read the faded ink, but it appears to be an advertisement for an opera called Orpheus and Eurydice. I remember studying it in our opera section of music craft history. It's the story of the god of music, Orpheus, whose beloved Eurydice is killed, so he journeys to the underworld to try to bring her back to life. Spoiler alert, it doesn't end happily. I shiver. Darby gives a low whistle. "It's dated 1941. This place has been closed for a long time." A thump sounds from the other side of the room, and all three of us shriek. Clutching Darby's arm, I stare as one of the thick curtains rustles aside to reveal Mr. Stewart, dressed in his tux jacket and kilt. He thumps his cane again.
"Come," he rasps. "He is waiting."
As we walk across the ruined lobby toward Mr. Stewart, Darby whispers,
"You know we're walking into a trap, right?"
"Yep," I reply.
"And you know there's really no reason the Necromuse couldn't just take us all prisoner."
"Yep."
"And you know that nobody knows where we are or how to find us?"
"You're starting to sound like Jai," I point out, feeling a pang. "Have you figured out a plan yet, Wonder Girl?" Mia asks. My voice shoots up an octave. "Nope." Mr. Stewart holds aside the curtain, allowing us to step into an enormous concert hall. The place is in worse shape than the lobby. Dust covers the thousands of velvet seats arcing around a grand stage. The peeling walls and the upper balcony look ready to cave in, and large swaths of fraying blue silk that had been pinned to the ceiling now hang in tatters. On the stage, ragged curtains frame a painted backdrop depicting an ancient Grecian city, the colors faded to pastels. Wooden beams hang down like sagging tree branches, and on the floor, old bricks, cloth, and broken furniture are piled beneath layers of dust. But the midnight orchestra, arranged neatly on the stage, is spotless. "Jai!" I shout, catching sight of my friend. He sits in the violin section, his instrument propped on his knee. He's wearing the same creepy doll mask as the other musicians, or hostages, rather,
but I don't need to see his face in order to recognize those ears. He's clearly in a trance, no doubt thanks to an earworm. Every one of the hostages sits as still as a statue, almost lifeless.
Wait, is that your mom?
Darby whispers to Mia, pointing at the masked pianist. Mia nods, her eyes hard.
She always wanted to be a concert pianist, but she didn't have the talent, she says bitterly.
I guess she got her wish in a way. Once I've seen that Jai is present and breathing, I can focus on the figure standing in front of the orchestra. My eyes slide to him, full of dread. Mr. Midnight, the Necromuse.
Dad.
He's dressed in a black suit, his mask white porcelain from his nose to his forehead. Before, his masks had covered his whole face, but this time I can see the scruffy beard on his jaw and the grim line of his mouth. His dark hair is combed to mostly cover his ears, hiding the bars I now know are there. In his hands, he holds his violin and bow, the latter lightly, rhythmically tapping his leg. Our footsteps echo in the tattered concert hall as we walk down the aisle. We're grouped close together, with Darby in the middle. I don't even remember grabbing her hand. I squeeze her fingers so hard her bones practically crunch.
I have so many questions.
How long has he been the Necromuse? Does anyone else know his real name? How many people has he kidnapped over the years? Has he ever thought of me? Has he ever regretted leaving?
We stop in front of the stage, staring up at that blank white mask.
Dad sure doesn't look regretful. He looks as emotionless as a gargoyle. My heart drums in my chest. My flute, still tucked inside my coat, feels as heavy as lead.
Miss Jones, you've come to bring me my spell.
I nod once, my mouth too dry to speak. Darby gives me a sideways look, eyebrows raised. I return a small, tight smile, hoping she can see I'm not serious. I'm just buying time. Every minute is precious, another chance to spark an epiphany of what exactly I am going to do. Because I honestly have no plan, no idea, no clue how to get Jai and the three of us safely away from here and still do something to help Mia's mom and the other hostages. Every one of those people is someone's father or mother or son or daughter, a person probably dearly missed. Mia told me that some of them have even been presumed dead. They've been missing for so long. Revulsion surges in me, hot and spiked. That man may be my father, but he's also a monster who has hurt a lot of people. It won't be enough to simply escape. He has to be stopped. Dad gestures toward a curving stair on the side of the stage. I take a deep breath, nod to Darby and Mia, then walk up alone, nervously running my fingers over the keys of my flute. The wooden stairs creak under my shoes. On the stage, I pause, staring at Dad across the expanse of floorboards between us. He waits motionlessly. My hands are sweating. I wipe them on my pants, but the flute is still slippery in my grasp. Swallowing hard, I take a few steps closer, as cautious as if I were crossing a thin layer of ice over a deep river. Every footfall sends creaks and pops echoing through the old floorboards. Finally, I stop a few feet away and stare at his shiny black shoes.
Give me my spell, Miss Jones, and we can part ways with no more trouble. You can see that your friend is unharmed, but to ensure his continued safety, you must pay off your debt to me.
For the first time I can remember, I look at my father. Really look at him, face to face, or mask, I suppose, as I've always been too afraid to do in the past, even when he was just a memory. Now here he is, real and in person, the shadow that's lurked behind me sprung fully to life, out in the light at last. I look at him and I realize I understand him. Once I look past the mask, the drama of the ruined concert hall, and the orchestra of mind-controlled people. Behind the grandeur and mystery he's built around himself, the names, Mr. Midnight, the Necromuse, whatever else he's been, and I just look at him. I see a broken, desperate man.
I've glimpsed him before, under the northern lights, when he leaned close and told me he wanted me to raise the dead for him. But I hadn't fully understood what he was saying, or what, or rather who, he really wanted. He wants Mom. That has to be why he's doing all this. The hostages, the shady deals, the whole midnight orchestra thing. It's all part of his quest to find a spell that will raise my mom from the dead. For the first time, I really, truly understand. It wasn't my fault. He didn't leave because of anything I did, or because Mom died saving me, or because I was broken or not worth staying for. His leaving had nothing to do with me at all. He left because he was broken, because he felt guilty, because he was scared and desperate and heartbroken. My dad left, and it's not my fault. Deep inside me, something heavy crumbles. More than anger, more than sadness, it was guilt weighing me down. I really have been blaming myself for my dad leaving, thinking something must have been wrong with me, thinking I didn't deserve to feel angry at him. Now it's like wings are sprouting from my back and suddenly I can fly. This is why I've been unable to face my anger, to feel it, to let it out the way Miss Mott wanted me to. This is why I couldn't compose. This is why I was afraid for so long. The guilt was in the way, but the guilt was a lie. And now the lie is gone. Heat against my leg draws my attention, and I peek into my pocket. The mood bead Miss Mott gave me backstage is blazing red, just like the beads that day in her cottage, the day the memory recall spell took me back to my childhood with my dad. And now that bead burns brighter and hotter than ever. With strength like that, Miss Mott told me, you might compose a spell to stop time itself. Suddenly, I know exactly what to do. I have all the power I need. All right, I whisper, raising my flute and looking my father in the eyes. Here's your spell.